Now, Robert, I alluded to the idea of chords. And the impetus, the way George describes it in the introduction to chapter 2, that he had a conversation due to the close camaraderie in the 1940s and 50s and 60s amongst the great jazz innovators. Miles Davis used to hang out with George, and they were close friends, and they used to talk. And at one point, George tells the story that Miles and he were sitting around, and George, being a very contemplative, spiritually oriented person who was always looking for the deeper meanings of things, said, "Miles, what is your musical aim?" And he meant that on a pretty deep level, not like, would you like to make more money or things like that. And Miles understood that completely. But what Miles came back with totally floored George and changed the course of his life. And Miles said, "I want to learn all the changes." And for those listeners who aren't familiar with the jazz expressions, we say the jazz vernacular in terms of the way people have their own language and code words. Changes means harmony or chords.
The progression of chords.
Exactly.
Through a sequence.
And how you would play any particular chord, and in the case of Miles Davis as a trumpeter, how you would take a solo playing melodic improvisations that would have a sense of unity and relate to whatever Miles was hearing at the moment that he was playing, because he was always improvising, with the chord changes in a song. So, for example, we're talking right now about the late 1940s, early 1950s, where the majority of jazz musicians were playing from the American songbook, standards, show tunes, as well as original compositions by the innovators of those times. And they would have a melody and they would have a harmony. So when you talk about learning all the changes, that means that no matter what song you were playing, whatever the chord progression and the harmony that was written, you would be able to know all the possible colors, like a painter, every shade of every possible color. And so what was George's response as he tells the story? He said, "But you're Miles Davis. I thought you already knew all the chord changes," because Miles was already had spent years on the bandstand.
Miles didn't know all the possibilities.
Right. And he had gone to Juilliard to study. So what that meant to him as well as to George is that Western music theory must be not giving us the entire story. Because for the most part, Western music theory is built on assumptions about what the most famous classical composers were doing, and people who analyzed their music and then realized they must, these composers of all, you know, starting with Bach primarily and moving forward in history, what they were doing. But that wasn't helping Miles Davis learn all the changes. So when George said, "But you're Miles Davis, you already know all of the chord changes," Miles said, "I don't, and I can't figure it out." So George spent a number of years trying to answer that question. And what he realized is what changed the direction of jazz, as he is credited for, to the modal period.
In fact, both of them may have been right, really, because what I'm parsing from what you're saying is that Miles Davis did know the chord changes because he was Miles Davis. Mm-hmm. Miles Davis. He just couldn't explain what all of them were.
But there were things that he didn't know that George helped him to discover, and that ended up producing the new music that was innovated by Miles that became the recording that we started our radio show with, A Kind of Blue.
And this is modal jazz.
This is modal jazz. Now, most people, including a lot of jazz musicians, still feel that the word mode, modal, modality, and modal jazz are on the ambiguous side. And people are, of course, entitled to interpret it the way they want. But relative to the innovator, through the Lydian chromatic concept of tonal organization, who discovered and brought to light the existence of tonal gravity, which is not George's idea. It's not a good idea. It's a law based on physics and the overtone series. And as we prove in this book, and we might want to talk about this in future radio programs, the degree to which we can show that Bach, as well as Maurice Ravel, Debussy, and many other composers prior to the jazz era, because the leading chromatic concept is a pan-stylistic and the only full-blown music theory to come from jazz, which you can apply to all previously existing music, as long as it's in equal temper tuning.
Right.
Because we are dealing with the subdivision of the octave into 12 semitones, and the way that it's tuned, where you hear the perfect fifths, brings to light the existence of tonal gravity.
And when we talk about equal temperament, we talk about a system that acknowledged the fact that you couldn't simply progress through fifths, octaves, the overtone series, with all tones being exactly equal ratios of the other, that there's always a little bit of an error
mm-hmm.
as you progress through these intervals, correct? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And you couldn't tune a piano now without being able to use equal temperament to vary some of those intervals slightly.
That's true. And when you study the art of, let's say, tuning a piano, you realize that going back to Pythagoras, who figured this system out, he knew that there had to be a mistake inserted in it, and it's actually termed the Pythagorean comma.
Right.
And that little mistake of vibrations and what we call beats in the note allows you to spread out those perfect fifths so that they sound perfect no matter where you play them. And on the piano, because you have such a huge range from the lowest note to the highest note of the 88 keys, you actually have to spread them out also as you get higher, a little bit sharper, based on how the human ear hears it, and a little bit flat as you go lower. It depends on the piano, and of course, different tuners have their own basic idea.
In the arrival of this at the keyboard, you were referring to Bach understanding this, was the inspiration for the well-tempered clavier.
Playing songs in different keys, in all the 12 different keys.
Right.
Beautiful. So what George found, and what I would like to present to you and our listeners as one important way to view what modality, modal jazz, modal tonics, what it means is that George came back with what you might say is the ultimate Zen answer to Miles when he then taught him what he had discovered and ended up becoming his full-fledged, world-renowned treatise, The Leading Chromatic Concept of Tonal Organization, The Art and Science of Tonal Gravity, is that there is no such thing as a chord. Uh-oh. There's no such thing as a chord. That's what modal jazz proved. There's no such thing as a chord. And what that means is that you can express, when you have a single Lydian tonic and your ladder of fifths that, by the way, extends beyond just the seven tones, because we only did a seven-tone scale. You have the 8-tone, the 9-tone, the 10-tone, the 11-tone, and the 12-tone order, more successions of fifths. And there is a slight variant in the 8th tone, which I can talk about maybe at another time, regarding a direct ladder of fifths. But the idea of having 12 tones that in some way are all fifths apart allows you to have another distinction that's very important that needs to be brought out right now, which is that the majority of Western music theory teaches the sound of music as compartmentalized into consonant and dissonant. We tend to think that the things that most people find sound beautiful, harmonious, relaxing, stimulating, we tend to call that consonant sounding, pleasing sounding. And most people, when they hear the word dissonance, they immediately think of something that sounds less comfortable, clashing, maybe gives you a headache, makes you feel like you don't want to listen to it again through repeated listenings. And there's a spectrum of that view of what sounds consonant and what sounds dissonant. George, as a product of the development of jazz, which was always searching for a new voice in the 20th century, and hopefully we still are today, felt that that was too subjective. Because who's to say that something that John Coltrane might play that might have sounds in it that sound very different and don't sound like a lullaby or a beautiful Beethoven sonata or Mozart or something like that, who's to say that that is dissonant? And for example, when I was very young, I started listening to Coltrane, and my parents would say, how could you listen to it? It sounded dissonant to them, which I understand, and they're entitled to that. I said, I can't explain it, but to me, this sounds like the most soothing, beautiful music. It's speaking a language that I understand. So when you have one single Lydian tonic, and then notes that go away in fifths, farther and farther into the chromatic universe, which turns out to be 144 possible intervals in a grid, because you have 12 keys of music, like playing in the key of C, playing in the key of G with the key signature, etc. And you also have 12 tones in each one of those keys. So you have the C 12-tone scale, then you have the D-flat 12-tone scale, so you have 12 times 12, 144 possible intervals. I hope I'm not losing our listeners, but just to show the spectrum of when we say close to distant relationships. The first seven tones of fifths, the Lydian scale, would be representing the most ingoing, and we're using that word, ingoing, meaning closely related to the Lydian tonic, and Western music theory might call that the most consonant sound. Just like how this sounds very pleasing.
Right.
But as we start to add notes that are a fifth above that, a fifth above that, it starts to sound farther away. And so George emphasizes in this system stepping away from consonant and dissonant and interpreting that as being a little bit too subjective. Like, there's people that listen to all kinds of music. I mean, someone I know just came back from a concert at Juilliard, and they said that this premiere of a brand new piece created this year in 2017 for a saxophone ensemble was nothing that except that sounded like coughs and burps, sounds
right.
coming out of these saxophones. Now, to that composer, that might have sounded, maybe he's got a cough and an indigestion, and that sounded like his music. So who's to say what's consonant and what's dissonant?
Or an adjective that describes things unpleasant.
Exactly.
Not necessarily a reflection of the sound itself.
Right. And so in the Lydian chromatic concept, you have close to distant relationships with no subjectivity of what sounds right or wrong or good or bad.
But it's pulled back towards that interval of the fifth.
Right.
In, under the principle you describe as tonal gravity.
Right. But as you go from fifth to fifth to fifth to fifth, it would be like the planets getting farther and farther away from the sun. It's just close to distant relationships. And so, what is modal jazz again? What is this idea that I just said that sounds so shocking, there's no such thing as chords? It turns out that you have ingoing territory, like closest to the sun of the Lydian tonic, the do of the Lydian scale. You have semi-ingoing, which is a little bit farther away, but still has the feeling of being close enough. You have semi-outgoing, and you have outgoing. Those are four delineations that George set, and those are called tonal levels. And the chords and the structures of the harmonies that Miles Davis wasn't able before he worked and interacted with George and this became the modal period that Miles Davis's music is famous for bringing in, but a lot of people don't know that it came from George Russell's Lydian chromatic concept, is that if you take a note, a single note, of any of the Lydian scales, of which it turns out that there's only seven principal scales, that's what George calls them. There's not 20 of them or 50, there's only seven. That if you build chords using a single tone of those seven scales, you can actually produce almost every traditionally definable chord in Western music, which is what Miles Davis said was his goal. But this idea that there's no chords is that there's only scales. So for example, let's take the C Lydian scale. And like what most people learn on their first piano lesson, let's take the C major triad, because we're not playing an F or an F sharp, we're just playing C, E, and G. Now, instead of thinking about that as a chord, think of it as the first step of the C Lydian scale, skip the second, play the third step of the scale, and then play the fifth step. So those are scale steps, okay? So even though we call this a chord, and yes, we still have to refer to it as a chord, it's really not, in terms of George's concept, anything except three tones of a scale, but instead of playing it as what we would say a broken chord or arpeggio, or if it was a song that started with those three notes as a melody, we're playing them at the same time. But here's what turns it into a chord. If I take what's called mode one, now we're using the modal language, mode one just means the first step of the scale, which is the Lydian tonic, and if I superimpose on mode one, which is the C, it gives birth to the sound of major. And that's because you're playing C, E, G with a C in the bass. Now, Western music theory teaches that every major key has a relative minor on the sixth step. It turns out it's the same whether it's a major scale or a Lydian scale. So if I go up six steps from C, either the major or the Lydian, it doesn't matter. If I still play that C, E, G, now I put mode six in the bass, those scale tones produce what George calls primary modal genre minor. Just by having the scale tone number six in the bass, that's what gives birth to the sound of what we're calling a chord. And if I play a scale that I play the C Lydian scale over it, it sounds much more ingoing and harmonious with that F sharp instead of with the F. See? That's not bad or wrong, but it sounds more outgoing. So the most ingoing unity, we call it a vertical alliance, between the C Lydian scale and its mode six, which is the sixth step, gives birth to the minor sound. Let's do one more, because the three most famous, especially in jazz, most widely used chord families are major chords, minor chords, and seventh chords.
Right.
So if it turns out that a Lydian scale has the ability to produce any form of a seventh chord, for those listeners that have a more advanced knowledge of jazz harmony, you know that a seventh chord can be extended. We call them extensions or extended chords. You can have a seventh or a ninth or an 11th or a plus 11 or a 13. So if I put the C, E, G and I put the second step in the bass, a D, the interval from D, the modal tonic, to C, the Lydian tonic, is a seventh. So that means anything I play with C Lydian, as long as I have that D in the bass, I'm improvising in my right hand with a C Lydian scale. I'm playing notes of the C Lydian scale here. But as long as I have a D in the bass, I'm going to have the sound of sevenths. And that's why George, temporarily, because we're so used to using the word chord that you can't get away from it, but when he says there's no such thing as a chord, he's trying to emphasize what the Lydian chromatic concept, which we also just abbreviate and call the concept, is alluding to, which is that you have the ability to create any chord that you want, especially when you use the more outgoing scales of the seven principal scales. when you take a scale tone, which is called a modal tonic, in the bass, and because it's that modal tonic in the bass, George renames the word for the sake of explaining this, that you're not playing a chord. He calls it a chord mode. So the D is the most important thing. Now let's get back to that first tune, So What? So What? On the Kind of Blue album, which to this day people say, if you had to pick the most popular, the most legendary, and some critics say the best, even though that's hard to determine, jazz album of all time, even in 2017, it's on almost everybody's list as the top three or the top five albums, not just the top 10 or 100. So Kind of Blue is still to this day inspiring people, and the majority of people know it, and So What is the most famous composition on it. It doesn't even have a melody, and it doesn't have any kind of chords like, you know. It doesn't have chords like that. You have a bass line with no melody that you would sing. And then this little echo. And these are what's called fourth chords, very open. And we didn't say this before, but an inverted fifth is a fourth,
that's
and an
correct.
Inverted fourth is a fifth. So this chord, which was a new sound at that time, brought in by McCoy Tyner and other pianists, listening and playing along with John Coltrane and Miles Davis, you know, at that time in the 50s and the 60s. So you have. So it goes on like that for section A, 8 bars, and then another section A. And then to express this modality that you can be freed by not being encumbered by playing, let's say, all the complex chord progressions that are in a standard like Body and Soul that Coleman Hawkins played and made famous, or Billy Strayhorn's Lush Life that has some of the most complex harmonies you'll find in jazz. It just goes up a half step from this to this. And so you're playing an open-ended song that has F Lydian mode 6, which gives us the D minor sound.
Got
and
it.
Then G flat going up a half step, Lydian mode 6. So you have this sound and this sound. And that was such a departure from previous songs where you were chained, so to speak, or jazz musicians who were constantly seeking freedom felt chained. And it allowed them to feel free that we can now play any notes of any scales, ingoing, semi-ingoing, semi-outgoing, and outgoing. And as long as the bass player is playing that mode 6, and then in the bridge when it goes up a half step, then we've just broken the barrier out of chords. But of course, look at all the incredible jazz harmonies that came from this. So it's not like you're not supposed to play chords or if you're not hearing harmonies. For example, I love going from an E minor 13 with a flatted fifth. I just love the lushness of that chord. And then going down a fifth to A, but playing it with what we call a flat 9, a raised 9, and a plus 5. And through studying the Lydian chromatic concept, I realized that there is no such thing as an E minor flat 5, although I can label it and name it that. But this is actually a B flat Lydian augmented scale. That's with a raised fifth. But it has the E in the bass, which is giving me the sound of that E minor with a flat 5. So, see? I'm playing the notes that just, and then when I go down a fifth to A, I actually go from B flat as the Lydian tonic, the note that has the unity with that chord, up a minor third to D flat and play a D flat Lydian augmented with the raised fifth in the bass. So I'm playing these two scales. And when I play the first one, I put that in the bass. When I play the second one, I put that note in the bass, and then I get... So those are the semi-ingoing, the more finely attuned shades in between, let's say, a standard E minor going to a standard A7. Because in most music, you would hear this. That's the origin of the two right. chords I played. Right. But instead of this, I'm playing this. And instead of this, I'm playing this. So when Miles was saying he wanted to learn all the changes, he was talking about all of the little steps in between the most standard ways of interpreting chords and every nook and cranny as you get towards utilizing the more outgoing versions of the Lydian scale, with when you superimpose them on an individual note of that scale, called a mode, you have all the colors, and then hence all the traditionally definable chords in Western music. And the only other thing that I'd like to say is that while this was all happening, Robert, there was a huge trend that was taking over jazz that made George very uncomfortable. It was called by many different names, but let's just refer to it by one of its most famous names. This was a period that came around the time of modal jazz, but mostly afterwards. And that was called free jazz, where people felt, like I was saying before, with burps and coughs on an instrument, that you could just go, or people playing the piano just... And most of us who have listened to jazz have heard at one time or another people playing very free music that we would also describe from a classical standpoint as atonal. It doesn't have a do, it doesn't have a melody you can sing. And jazz musicians felt like this was one way for them to express themselves. George didn't have a problem with them doing that, but what he felt was that there was so little discipline in what they were doing that they were either playing, you know, like if it was Body and Soul, they were either playing like a standard club tune, you know, which is what right. Western music would call extremely consonant. There was that, and then when they get together at another club and play free jazz, it would be... Right. And he's like, wait a second, what's in between?
Right.
And so one of the reasons that he dedicated himself from a social point of view and a cultural point of view as a black man in this development of this music where it was at historically was he wanted to create a vocabulary and a vernacular where his contemporary musicians, who the ones who picked up on it and utilized it to a strong degree, were the pianist Bill Evans, who studied the Lydian chromatic concept with him. George worked with John Coltrane, and John Coltrane was very well aware of George's work, and they were close friends and they played together. Eric Dolphy, who played with John Coltrane, studied the concept, and then Miles Davis connection, as well as many other people, was very powerful at the time that this was happening. They were expressing ingoing, semi-ingoing, semi-outgoing, and when they'd play outgoing, which you could describe that, they were still conscious of where's the center of tonal gravity. George liked, as a person who was interested in metaphysics and psychology and what you might call things from the heart and wisdom, not just things of the mind, George said that you have to always be conscious in your life and your music of where the center of tonal gravity is. So, for example, sometimes when people meet us in our points in our lives when we're down in the dumps or we're, you know, not feeling good. They'll say, you don't seem like yourself, or you seem like you're out of sorts, or we've all experienced what it feels like to not feel like us or to be out of touch with ourselves. So George said, in our lives, we have to be in touch with that center of tonal gravity that he called our essence. He said, there's that beauty and that truth in the essence of who you are. And your music, you need to be conscious of wherever the Lydian tonic is. Like if you're in a solar system, you still have to know where the sun is, especially if the sun is providing you what it does for us and keeping us alive. So for example, I cannot think of anything except, I hope I don't scratch my elbows when I go. Or right. I can think, you know what? No matter what I'm doing there, I'm still relating to the fact in my mind as I'm developing my free jazz improvisational solo that F is the center of tonal gravity. So as I go, I'm hearing F. And then there's a structure and an order to the expression of that. And that was another reason that in this time of modal jazz and where it's gone since, that George's system offers everything from the most ingoing to the most outgoing and all styles of jazz and freedom, but something where you are conscious at all times of the center of tonal gravity, the Lydian tonic.
And bring us back to that one point that you mentioned. So you referred to 144 permutations.
Possible intervals, yes.
And what gives us that math?
Well, we talked about 7/5. The 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th possible tones in a C scale would be a fifth above the F sharp, a fifth above the C sharp, right? And so we add more notes until, interestingly enough, the fourth step, you know, do, re, mi, fa,
right.
That's 12 notes a fifth apart. So in terms of tonal gravity, this sound.
Until it brings us back to that C, you're saying.
Exactly.
Right? Yes.
And isn't it interesting that the sound of a C major scale, that note is actually the farthest of the 12 tones away in terms of a ladder of fifths. I find that interesting anyway.
And so if there are 12 of those, if there are 12 of those fifths,
mm-hmm.
12
keys that are related by fifths, because we most of us know from memorizing and studying what's considered to be the most important diagram, and this is one of the things that I always find amusing,
the
circle of fifths,
yes,
will tell you how every scale, chord, and key is related. It's by fifths.
Right.
So obviously the existence of tonal gravity can't be overlooked.
So the 12 fifths that bring us from C to C,
and then
times the number of fifths and the circle of fifths,
right,
give us the 144.
Right. And you keep getting farther away. So for example, the next key, if you go in a sharp direction on the circle of fifths from C, would be a fifth above C, which is G. So then we start with the 12 tones of the G Lydian scale. And when we are, let's say I want to improvise on something that is in C Lydian, but I want to make it a little bit more outgoing than even the C Lydian 12 tones can give me, I could either play in the G Lydian key, or I could go in a flat direction from C down a fifth to F and start playing in F Lydian. There'll be two different psychological and tonal effects from going in those directions. And so you start playing in other keys that are farther away in either a sharp direction or a flat direction. And that's where the 12 keys, each having 12 tones, gives you a grid. That's what we call it, the tonal gravity grid of close to distant relationships. And you pick what's consonant or dissonant to you. And it's not based on the previous existence of what anybody else has done. Because that's another thing. George Russell was an incredible innovator. I hope from the music that you'll be playing for our listeners that they'll be able to appreciate and go online and see that electronic music. George Russell was one of the first people, not the only one, but one of the first people to start to use electronics, especially with his composition, Electronic Sonata for Souls Loved by Nature. He had great titles. His composition, Listen to the Silence, and others that have events like the African Game and Vertical Form are influenced by Stravinsky, but they developed completely new territories of music that jazz had not explored. He was a master of rhythm, and a lot of his rhythmic inventions, including the fact that he's, along with Dizzy Gillespie, his composition Cubana B, Cubana Bop, brought in and ushered in the music that we still enjoy today, which is the marriage between Afro-Cuban music and jazz. And the list goes on. There was a big movement towards, we don't usually use this word anymore, but we called it jazz rock in the 60s and the 70s. And it was because the jazz musicians were losing their jobs and everybody was listening to the rock music in the hippie days. And there was some unbelievably great rock music. George Russell was one of the first people to write his own original jazz rock, and he did that by being inspired, you know, from hearing the rock music that he loved.
And how does that relate to the term jazz fusion?
Well, jazz fusion is represented by so many different styles, it's hard to say. You could call the majority of music that George did jazz fusion. He didn't, but you could, because he was always fusing ideas, because he was searching, like so much of what is so difficult to define, especially from the 50s on, 1950s, what is jazz? It's very difficult. And myself, as a lifelong jazz musician, I can't really define jazz, because each person's music is so individual and signature. And these innovators brought about such fast-moving developments in all of this music that's grouped together in jazz.
Now, is someone who, I'm thinking of a name of someone who is pushing the envelope a bit today, Pat Metheny. Mm-hmm. So would what Pat Metheny is doing now be possible without the groundwork laid by George Russell?
Well, there are a number of artists that I know who have been either slightly or indirectly or very directly and profoundly influenced by George's work. And I have a great appreciation for Pat Metheny's music, and I listen to his CDs from time to time. But I don't like to speculate. It would only come in my past, and now that George Russell has passed away as of 2007, I can't add to that. But whatever George told me in terms of stories, I know that I heard it from the source, and he never mentioned Pat Metheny. But Pat Metheny has very open ears, and he worked with people like Ornette Coleman, who, you know, most people don't know this, but George was one of the first people to recognize Ornette Coleman as an innovator, and was trying to explain to other people why he was as great as he was at the very beginning of Ornette Coleman's musical career, when he moved from Texas, where he's from, to New York City to try to allow his music to spread around the world and grow and play with other people. So, you know, the camaraderie and the culture and the interaction of so many people back in the day, we can't say whose idea it was. It was like I've had the great opportunity of working with in the past and learning so much from the beautiful society of tap dancers who tap danced on stage with the big band era. And they had a club that was actually presided over by Billy Strayhorn, who was not a tap dancer, but one of the biggest influences on me as a musician. And they're called the Copacetics. And through hanging out with them and being able to accompany them and be their musical director on a few projects, they explained to me how everybody's tap dance steps was influenced by everybody else's tap dance steps, and they would perform at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, and then when their show was over, they would sit in the audience and watch the other tap dancers when they'd come, and they would either be learning, studying, what you might call stealing a step, but this is what the culture was and why it thrived so beautifully. So it's really hard to say somebody like Pat Metheny, you'd have to ask him, and I'd love to know. I would be shocked if he said that he wasn't aware of the concept, that he might have studied it. If he said he didn't, I would be surprised. But I know that he's amongst many of the greatest musicians of our time who definitely do acknowledge that George Russell is one of the greatest contributions to music, to world music, to the African-American music that we call the jazz tradition, and the Lydian chromatic concept, the only full-blown theory to come from jazz.
You bring to mind a famous quote of George Russell's, I hope I get it right, in that he was very self-effacing about his own very prodigious skills at the piano. Mm-hmm. And he said, I don't play the piano, I play the Lydian chromatic concept.
Beautiful. I think you said it the way that he said it. And, you know, I would encourage our listeners to explore what now is approximately 30 releases that I think have been reissued on CD, and now with the streaming music phenomenon are probably available for listening pleasure on iTunes and Spotify and other forms of digital music distribution that will allow people to also realize that while he said he was playing the Lydian chromatic concept, he felt that his life as a composer and musician and band leader was separate, in the sense that he was still utilizing his own concept the way anybody else would, meaning that I've studied it, I assimilate it, I practice it, and I have my music, and it's part of allowing me to articulate my language. But when you listen to almost 30 albums of George Russell's music in all of these different styles that he's famous for, you'll realize that he was a singular talent, and what he heard and what he had to say and what he was expressing, he was using the Lydian chromatic concept. But anybody can use the Lydian chromatic concept to create any music within equal temper tuning that they want. And one of the reasons I'm saying that, Robert, is that over the 30 to 40 years that I've been working alongside with him and now by myself, so many people, when they hear George's music, they go, well, I don't really like his music, so obviously I wouldn't like the Lydian chromatic concept. And in that way, I want to encourage people to realize that the Lydian concept is for anybody at any style at any time for whatever is your music. It's language. It would be like saying, I don't like the way that person speaks, and since they're speaking in English, I don't want to speak English. Well, obviously, if you have beautiful things to say, what the language is helping you communicate those ideas.
And there's a whole realm of other tonality besides what we call typically Western music. Mm-hmm. And I think what George Russell gave us an insight into is that not everything has to be bound by that diatonic system.
Exactly.
That one that has the two points of tension. That as we look east, there are textures in music that can sound complete and at rest, mm-hmm. without needing those points of tension that mm-hmm. that require resolution.
That's beautiful. May I give you a demonstration of a Beatles song?
I would love that.
I hope people like my choice of this song. I love the Beatles songs because I think they offer so much room, like many standards in the American songbook, for interpretation. And I can give you a demonstration of one way that, after all of this very technical talk, and I appreciate the patience of our listeners to stick with us. I hope we haven't lost them with so much of the deep technical information, but Robert, thank you for letting me get into the depths of it, because it is so new to so many people, even if they've had 5, 10, 15, or 20 years of music theory. But it's always nice to know, well, then how would I use it, or how would I hear it? And it should be something you can hear and feel. So one of my favorite Beatles songs that I like to reinterpret and harmonize is Norwegian Wood. Now, it turns out that Norwegian Wood was actually composed by the Beatles in using an ancient Celtic scale, which on the white keys, if I'm going to stick to that, which I will right now, because then people might be able to try it at home. You can try this at home, as opposed to don't try this at home. If we play it in the key of G, it starts on the so, do, re, mi, fa, so. And I'll just play the melody and just take my word for it that these are all white keys. So we're going in the key of G, but instead of it having an F sharp, we're having an F. Now, we've already said that all the white keys, if it was a Lydian scale, it would have to be F Lydian.
Right.
So this is actually F Lydian mode 2, but it's represented as what's referred to as conceptual modal genre, which means that it has a horizontal feeling of resolving, because if you play the G major scale and you have that C, as in, there's the fa.
Uh-huh.
There's the fa again. There's the fa again. So you have this feeling, if I'm going to play it in a very horizontal way, accentuating the major scale aspect of it, even though it doesn't have an F sharp, it has an F. And I'll keep it simple first. And it keeps on feeling like we're at a place of rest. We want to resolve. Wanna resolve. Wanna resolve. So you can feel the horizontal nature, which is more of the major scale. Now, if we have converted that song from G major to its parent, that's where we call it, the parent Lydian scale, which is from F to F, all the white keys. Now I'm going to do what I did before, where I'm going to play just mode 1, F in the bass, and let you hear how this same melody, if I don't have G in the bass, but I'm going to have F, it's going to sound totally vertical and not like it's resolving at all. Same melody, but now F in the bass. Enhance it a little bit so it'll sound prettier. The whole time it was in a state of verticality or unity.
Right.
Now, one of the reasons that no matter how much I do want to go back in time and meet my heroes who have kept me going, like my other mentor, Dwight Mitchell, like Art Tatum, so many people that everybody admire. John Coltrane, if I could have spent a day with him and go back in a time machine, I would do anything for that. But I got to tell you, I've thought about this a long time, and Johann Sebastian Bach, he demand for me. So one of the things that I learn by feeling that Bach, without a doubt, understood and discovered for himself the precepts of tonal gravity, of vertical and horizontal, and I think that his music is drastically understood. And that could be an entire other radio show.
Wait,
if your
you're
listeners
saying
request.
His music is drastically
misunderstood.
Yes. Yes.
What did I? And
I think you said drastically understood.
Yeah, understood.
Exactly.
Thank you for correcting me. So one of the things about Bach was that when you look at his music from the point of view, I'm not saying it's the only way. I'm not saying my way of looking at it, which would be through George's eyes of the Lydian chromatic concept. But the Lydian chromatic concept, by the way, we should have said this before, it is primarily for people who analyze already existing music, for people who want to compose any type of new music, and people who want to improvise over already existing music, like how I'm improvising on the Beatles' Norwegian Wood.
Right.
So the thing about Bach was that a lot of his music was incredibly vertical, and he uses Lydian scales, and Lydian augmented scales, and Lydian diminished scales, and Lydian flat seven scales all over the place. So how can George in trying to define all the traditional definable chords in Western music, come up with 7 scales. And then you see the origin of all of those. And modal music was actually Bach, because Bach was counterpoint of individual melodies, meaning whatever is in the bass is giving birth to the sound of the chord. So there's so much that's in alignment between them. And George spoke about it, and we do analyze it in the book. So one of the things that I've learned in studying and analyzing through the eyes of the Leading Chromatic Concept, using it as a form of analysis, about Bach's music is he would go back and forth between a vertical and a horizontal. Now, if I play it all in the white keys with G, because there's a C relative to the G, I can't really express the true verticality of the Lydian sound if I harmonize the first part in G. I already expressed that it only sounds vertical in F, so what I'm going to choose is C Lydian. So that's all the white keys, but with the F sharp. And I'm going to go back and forth between C Lydian and the G that wants to resolve. And so instead of, right, or instead of with the F, now I have the choice of C as the center of tonal gravity. And that's just a personal interpretation today of it, but that shows you how when you start looking at harmonizing a melody in the modal perspective, I can pick either G or F or C, and then there's others, and they would sound possibly more outgoing.
As long as you've acknowledged what your center of gravity
is. That's the key.
And you don't lose sight of it.
That's the key. So here's another example with a standard tune, which is a Billy Strayhorn Chelsea Bridge. Now, the way that it's written, it starts with a melodic line, and then the first chord comes in, and it's listed in a standard lead sheet that jazz musicians would use to interpret this ballad by him as a B-flat minor with a major 7. So a B-flat minor, and the major 7 is actually the melody note, that kind of eerie sound. So the song as it's written goes like this. I'll play it very simply. And then he goes to an A-flat minor with a major 7. Now, my understanding of converting the B-flat minor with a major 7 into its parent scale is that B-flat, because it's a minor chord, means that it's built on the 6th step. So the only reason it sounds minor is because I have the 6th step of, and what is B-flat? The 6th step of D-flat Lydian. So I can automatically change the sound as it's written with that B-flat, and I can put the Lydian tonic in, and it's just a different version of the color of the chord, but I'm using the same materials as with the B-flat minor with a major 7. Same scale, D-flat, Lydian, augmented. Or I can pick a different note of the parent scale, B. Now I'll go to the one I did before. And then I can combine all of them. And I'm altering not chords. This is where the concept starts to become alive. These are, I'm thinking scale, 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 different scale, alter a note of the scale, alter a note of the scale. And depending on what the bass note is, that's what gives birth to that new sound.
Well, Andy, I want to thank you for elucidating this concept that people try all their lives to understand, and some understand it better than others. You understood it. You absorbed it with a speed that really won you George Russell's respect. And so the fact that you're still with us and you're still sharing this method with people, I think, is a great gift. To the jazz world.
Thanks.
And so we're coming to the end of our time for this show. I hope it's not the last that we do. I hope it's not our last collaboration on this. Mm-hmm. But let's really look at, as we close out, let's really take George Russell's work to its apex of the distance of the orbits around that center of gravity. And I think that piece would have to be Event 5 from his studio album in the 1980s. Would you agree?
Yes, Vertical Form.
Tell us a little bit more about that piece.
Well, I had a very unique introduction to that piece in the sense that he did not share with me or too many other people while he was working on a new composition, then when it was completed and being rehearsed, then it was being recorded and then mastered for release by a record label. And I went to one of my weekly lessons, because that was still while I was under once a week or twice a week lessons at his house, which was a great honor. And I walked into one of my lessons one day that I'll never forget. And I was always a little bit nervous because he was such a powerful and imposing and yet such a gentle and kind and loving teacher that I could never ask for a better mentor in him and guide. But I still was always, you know, he was always pushing me to eliminate everything that wasn't genuine about myself. And like most people when they're young, and I still struggle with it, we're still trying always to be more authentic in our behavior and our true selves. So I was sitting there nervously and saying, what do you have in store for me today? And he said, I don't want you to say anything or do anything. I'm just going to put these very high quality headphones on, and I just want you to sit and listen to this until it's over. And he didn't tell me what it was or anything. And I listened to this long piece. It was about 50 minutes divided into many different sections, I think five or six sections. And I had never heard music that was even closely resembled this. And most of us know that when we get turned on to a sound and a style of music and something's completely new, unlike anything they've ever heard, you're caught by surprise and off guard because you have nothing you can even relate it to. It didn't sound like a style or a genre or anything. And it moved me like an explosion. And I think most of us who love music have been moved by especially new music. So I took off the headphones when it was over, and he had a big smile on his face. And I said, I've never heard anything like that, and I am completely speechless. And the power and the message of it, I don't even know how to comprehend it. And he said, well, that was a surprise for you. That was my new album called Vertical Form. I just got back from the studio having mastered it, and now it'll be released. And you're the first person that I'm sharing it with. And, you know, I was blown away by that. And after I left that lesson, I had to be alone, and I couldn't talk to anybody or play music for a day or two because it transformed all of the energy in every cell of my body, which I think ultimately music has the power to do, and most of us have been moved like that, which is why we all, almost all of us, love music so much.
Thank you again, Andy Wasserman. Now that we understand the concept of vertical form, let's close out this episode of Jazz Discoveries with Event 5 from Vertical Form. I'm your host, Robert Bullington. Hope that you'll join us again soon for another edition of Jazz Discoveries.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's been an incredibly wonderful experience.
Gentlemen and the officers, thank you. Thank you.